This podcast covers a murder that occurred in 1983 in Reed City, Michigan. The opinions of the host and interviewees are simply that, opinions, not facts. As always, everyone is presumed innocent until otherwise proven in a court of law. I first covered Jeanette's case about a decade ago in Season 2. If you have not already listened to Season 2, I recommend starting there.
May 17th, Monday. Walked the kids to school today. Stopped by City Hall. Carol asked me to make her a plant hanger, so I went by Ben Franklin's to get the stuff. Back home, I watered the plants and repotted two Swedish ivy plants. I'm going to give Carol one of them. Mama came over for lunch and played with the gerbils and bird. I wrapped Daddy's curtains, went to the post office and mailed them. Then I went to City Hall to take Mama her hanger and Carol her plant. And then I went to the library. Seen an ad in the paper for someone to work at the pet department in Gamble's. I told Bonnie I wanted to apply, so she said to come back tomorrow and take a test and fill out the application.
When I learned that Michigan State Police had released more records related to the brutal murder of Jeanette Roberson, I knew now was the time to revisit her story. Based on how much they had released, I also knew that now was the time to talk about the things that I had withheld the first time around. I feel even more so now that I have spoken to Detective Sergeant Pratt again. Obviously, he's now retired, he's in his 80s, and hopefully living his best life. It was, again, a pleasure to speak with him. And since he was able to speak much more freely this time, I'll be able to share some of what we discussed throughout this season. But back when I covered this case for the first time around, I didn't have a single witness statement from the time period, because they had all been redacted. I also held back a lot of information that I had discovered at the time. While most of their overall recollections were close, they did in some cases not remember everything or remember differently. It was a good memory lesson for sure. These discrepancies weren't about big things, though, more like details. But the devil is in the details, as they say. Thinking about that turn of phrase now, I understand it more deeply, because the devil lurks in those details, like a killer stalking his prey, watching her every move. This season, you will finally hear from all of the Gamble's employees through their original witness statements. You'll hear what they said in 1983 and what they didn't say, and we will compare what they said to Detective Pratt to what they told other investigators who worked on this case, all the way up to when the cold case detectives came a-knocking.
June 14th, Monday. First day of work at Gamble's. It's a lot of work, a lot of responsibility. One thing done wrong could result in a lot of dead birds. Spent most of my time downstairs in the bird room. One bird down there I notice most often is a yellow male parakeet that's paralyzed on the left leg. He's no good for breeding now. I might bring him home. It's hard to remember which bird gets what seed and whether or not he gets a water bottle. The babies are most important. You have to check eggs and chicks every day. Bonnie is teaching me about the fish, how to tell male from female, and what other fish they'll get along with.
This is season 30 of Down and Away.
I tell you, if you want to commit a crime, come to Green City, because you never solve a thing.
From the beginning, they botched that scene so bad it was not funny.
It was eerie quiet. I mean, you couldn't hear a sound, and it should have told me that something was up, you know, but you don't think of stuff like that, because you couldn't even hear the birds sing, and that should have told you something.
They said that she was found in a storage room back beneath the front door.
This is creepy.
Yeah, I know.
Customers are right through that glass.
And I don't know if there were customers out there at the time.
It was very quiet in the store. There were birds back there, but I don't remember hearing them chirp or anything or peep or make their noises. So I think it was quiet in that room. But I remember it still just being a little dark and dreary and quiet.
The stairway was about in the middle of the store. You know, the upstairs, you'd go about halfway back, and if you were walking in from the street, it was on the right-hand side, and you just turned a little corner and went right straight down the stairs.
You can see through all these tanks to the back.
Yes.
I wouldn't think anybody would do anything where they could be seen.
Back here is a lot of place where something could have happened that nobody would have seen, but not heard. I can hear everything that's going on upstairs.
So we can absolutely hear
every footfall.
Off to the left, as you got down the stairs, was like a storage room. There was like a curtain or something there.
My two boys had to go upstairs to go to the bathroom, but then there was nobody downstairs. So my sister-in-law went up the stairs, and then my two boys went with her. So they left me down there by myself. She went up there to find an attendant to help. And I think they actually were wondering, they thought somebody was down there to work, but it took them a little while, I think, to get somebody to come down.
People were walking around asking, where's Jeanette? You know, they had nobody had seen her since lunch. One of the older ladies that worked there went down into the basement to look for her.
The owner of the store had actually told her, well, go downstairs and see if she's down there.
And she came running upstairs just white as a ghost.
And she put her head on the desk that we had right by the basement door there. And I thought she was having a heart attack is what I thought, you know. And then she just pointed to the basement. So then John ran down the basement, and then he come up and he said, close all the doors.
Had he checked to make sure nobody else, the killer wasn't in the store? I mean, it's a pretty big store. I would have been afraid to,
I don't know.
And then he came back, he wasn't down there for very long, and he came back up and said, there's nothing we can do for her now.
The police told, I know they told me, because I think we had to go talk separately or whatever, that they even thought at that time that he could have been in that room and that she was probably already, he probably had just killed her. They thought he could have still been hiding in there, or they just thought it was a good thing, like, Jan didn't go all the way in there. If he would have been still in there, something that would have been really bad.
I got the phone call the minute I sat down about a possible murder in the basement of Gamble's.
That individual must have been hiding in that dark area there. You know, where the other room, where you go into the other room, I bet you anything, somebody was hiding in there.
Okay, nobody's seen anybody go downstairs. Nobody's seen anybody come back upstairs. Nobody's seen anybody with a blunt instrument in their hand or anything else. All he would have had to do is take whatever he used, take it upstairs to where the apartment was, wash it off.
What crowbar?
Well, the one that they found. That
they found a crowbar. Okay.
Well, that's what supposedly killed her.
Okay, so where did they find the crowbar?
Well, it was on a ledge down there.
There was birds squawking, and she was lying, like, under these cages. I had to get on my hands and knees to get under them, and it was a young female in kind of a surreal picture that wasn't what I was expecting, especially being given what we were dispatched to. There was blood. Again, there was a lot of blood.
Dave was there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because I can still see him sitting on a crate.
Like I'm
saying, oh my gosh, he said, I just came from
Saginaw
to get rid of all this stuff like murders. And here I am in my own little store and I got a murder on my hand. But how people knew so quickly. Because the front of that store, we went and locked the door, John did. There was people out there that you wouldn't believe. How did they know?
You mean they were on the sidewalks looking around?
Wow. It was just something else. I mean, you know, it just seemed like they just all of a sudden flocked.
I remember being down in front of the store, and there was a lady inside standing at the door, and if I remember correctly, I took a picture of her. I believe she was crying. And the door was locked, and we weren't allowed in right away.
The only person who could move through that store randomly without being noticed by anybody, including the employee, is not even given another thought because he's always there.
When I talked to Detective Pratt, he said, I never saw any of these interviews. He didn't know anything about the blood. He hadn't heard about the blood.
I don't think that happened. We would have done something if we had been told that.
If he actually saw blood, why is he waiting for 3 years?
That would have been something we'd have caught on right away. If somebody had said, hey, he was in here and had blood on his jacket, well, you know what we'd be looking for.
This occurred in a very small town, and it's quite surprising that no one in the town came forward. Somebody had to have known. Small towns are not good at keeping secrets like this generally.
they solve this, and I'm totally vindicated, somebody is going to be sorry.
Saturday, January 15th. This morning I didn't want to go to work. I felt anxious. I had gone down to the pet shop last Sunday to feed all the varmints. Usually the boss, Bonnie, does that, but she and her family, they'd left for Canada the night before. She had left me in charge of the pet department until Thursday. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday I worked and I thought I did a pretty good job. Bonnie had left me plenty to do, and I found a lot more that needed to be done. I even took it upon myself to rearrange a few things. I mean, why should the fishnets be divided and kept in two different places? And why should the medicines hung on the pegboard be right above the fish food instead of beside the medicine on the shelf? There was a nice blank wall of pegboard over the gravel pits. That's what I call the bins where the gravel is kept. I hung all the nets on that according to size, and I made sure each had a tag behind it. Then I took down all the medicine hanging over the fish food and regrouped that to hang by the shelved medicine. Bonnie had left word that I was to begin inventorying the pet department, so I started that. Wednesday came and went. I made sure everything was just right before closing. That night, Bonnie and family returned from their trip. They stopped at the store to check up. Bonnie called me to tell me that I had left my billfold on the counter, and after I had tried so hard to have everything just right when she came back. Anyway, Thursday and Friday I head off from work, and I wondered what Bonnie thought of the way I tended the shop. Did she find many things left undone? Did I leave the frozen beef heart out again to thaw to a bloody mess? Was she checking my receipt book to find out if I had overcharged, or worse yet, undercharged a customer? So today, Saturday, I'm back to work. I get in 15 minutes early as usual. I go downstairs to the pet department, and I head straight for the checkout counter. Bonnie communicates with notes, as we don't see each other often. She works one day, and I the next. I search the counter nervously. If I needed to be bawled out about something immediately, she would write it down and leave it by the cash register, as that's the first place I go in the morning. No note. I breathe a little easier. Now for the bird room. The bird room is actually a small room in back of the pet department for housing all of the birds. The birds for sale are put in flight cages that are built into the wall with glass windows so that the customers can view them, but they can be fed and cleaned from the bird room. I spend my first hours of work taking care of the birds, so Bonnie has a large pad of paper beside the door to leave instructions and suggestions, and sometimes reprimands on.
That entry would never be finished. That's where it ended. And Jeanette Robertson would be killed 4 days later. So let's go back to January 19th, 1983. Bonnie Ingalls, who owned the Gamble store with her husband David Ingalls, had called Jeanette the night before she was killed and asked her if she would come into work on her day off. Bonnie's son was sick, and her husband David wasn't feeling well either. The store was expecting a couple truck deliveries the next day, and they were going to need more help. So Jeanette said yes. Alvin, her husband, was laid off of work for that week, so the extra money would come in handy. On the morning of January 19th, 1983, Jeanette and Alvin got the kids up and got them dressed, fed them breakfast, and then dropped them off at school. After that, together, the couple drove to the local unemployment office so that Alvin could claim his week of unemployment. And for those that are not familiar, it's common in Michigan for businesses to do layoffs, especially during the winter, for a couple of weeks or even months. When I lived in Michigan, my husband worked for a labor union, and his job was laid off for a couple of months every year when it was icy and the snow was so heavy they couldn't work, during which time he would pick up short-term jobs like plowing for the county or driving a garbage truck. What would happen is their bosses would technically lay the employees off so that they could claim unemployment rather than them go out and look for other work, since they weren't actually getting rid of employees. Once when my husband picked up a plowing job for Wexford County, he came home that first day, and he said that they had given him a couple things to do, and so he went out and he finished them, and he came back to the office, and his boss said,
"Slow down, son. You work for the county now."
We got a real chuckle out of that. But back in 1983, Alvin Robertson only had a week off to contend with, so he planned to work on his car, among other things. The Robertsons were only driving one of their vehicles at that time, and Alvin carpooled to work with some other guys because he didn't like driving his other car in the winter. It had a lot of chrome on it, so they stored it at Jeanette's mother's house. Alvin and Jeanette were at the unemployment office for about a half hour that Wednesday, and then they returned home and had coffee together before they left the house again. This time it was Jeanette driving her 1974 pea green four-door Chevy Nova. And I would say something about that car was memorable because a few people that I had spoken to remembered it specifically. Reed City is one of those small towns that if you live there, you know who's who, and it doesn't take long to figure out what everyone's driving. The city itself is only about 2 square miles, and historically, it boasts about 2,500 residents. If you've been there a while, you could literally know everybody, or at least know of them. Once Jeanette and Alvin arrived at Gamble's that morning around 9:45, Jeanette got out, and Alvin took the driver's seat. Jeanette was always early, according to her fellow employees, anywhere from 15 minutes to half an hour, and she often would get coffee with Angie and Flossie, the older female clerks, before starting work. Those two worked upstairs in the main Gamble store, and Jeanette worked downstairs in the basement pet department. So that day was no different. The women chatted for a bit about Alvin being out of work for the week and how he carpooled to work for $15 a week. Angie said that she had only met Alvin once, the previous fall at a sidewalk sale. On that last day of her life, Jeanette was wearing new jeans, and she had mentioned to Angie that she'd resisted purchasing them because of the cost. But her husband Alvin said, "You're getting a new pair of jeans." The report seems to indicate that her old jeans were tight on her, and that was the reason for the purchase of the new ones. After having coffee with the other clerks, Jeanette spoke to Bonnie Ingalls by phone, and it was right around 10 a.m. There was a customer who had come in asking about a part for a model train engine that had been sent in for repair. So in addition to pets and pet supplies in that pet shop, downstairs, the Ingalls sold model and craft items, which quite a few of the school students that I interviewed had mentioned. Toy rockets, model cars, things like that. There was a sign in the front window of Gamble's on the main floor that said Hobby Shop, and they were in the process of making part of the room downstairs in the next door connecting basement a hobby section, but it was still under renovation that day. And so if you looked into that room that day, you would see a saw and some other materials for that remodel, stacks of some bags. It was not open to customers, but there was a clear tarp hanging in that rough doorway between the basement pet department and the adjoining basement. During that phone call, Bonnie asked Jeanette if she had checked the cockatiel, and Jeanette said it was doing fine. She told her boss that she had listened to the bird eggs like she was supposed to. The back room had nesting cages, and just inside the middle door that led into the back room, there was a kiddie pool where they grew algae. There were bird cages built into the walls, and more cages in the back room where they were raising some of the birds from birth. Detective Pratt would later check the nesting houses in the back room of the pet department, and he would see the cards in those cages were dated January 19, 1983, in Jeanette's handwriting, indicating that she had performed that task earlier in the day before she was killed. During the phone call, Bonnie asked Jeanette to make sure to help her husband David Ingalls unload the freight from the trucks when it came in, because he also had a touch of the flu. So did her son, which is why Bonnie was home that day. Bonnie would tell investigators that on December 1st, the month earlier, Jeanette's days had been changed to Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays, her normal workday being from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Previous to that, Bonnie said Jeanette had worked Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Bonnie and Jeanette had swapped days. But I did see that in Jeanette's diary, she had also worked evenings for some period of time. On an entry dated October 26, 1982, about 3 months before she was killed, Jeanette wrote,
"Gotta go to work today. I don't want to, really. I learned that part-time people don't get raises. I could work for these people 10 years and never get a raise. With a job, I think you have to at least believe that you're progressing to be happy with it. I do as good a job as I can for Gamble's. Maybe I could get a job on the days that I don't work."
A month later, on November 29th, it said,
"Everything went rotten today. I didn't feel good and I started my period. And the kids didn't have any school because of the icy roads. But there's still no snow on the ground. I wonder where it is. Bonnie called today and told me I was working Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 3:30 to 7:30 p.m. and Saturday. She also gave me a 15-cent raise. I'll be making $3.50 an hour. I couldn't believe it. It was exactly opposite of what I expected to hear from her.
In the December 3rd entry, Jeanette mentions working 3:30 to 7:30 too, and that someone had called Animal Control about the way they kept their turtle at the store, saying that the tank was too small. Shortly thereafter, the diary entries start to indicate that she was again working in the morning, so it might just have been a few days that she worked that evening shift. But it is something to consider. Was the whole store open until 7:30? Or I imagine the clientele would be different than the folks who came in during the day? Or was Jeanette working after closing time? And if so, was she working alone? Or were there other employees working in the closed store with her? So at the time she was killed, Jeanette's normal workday was 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. On that call with Bonnie Ingalls on the day she was murdered, Bonnie also asked Jeanette if she could call her as late as 9:30 in the morning the next day, Thursday, if she needed her to work again, because of her son's illness, and Jeanette agreed. According to Bonnie, Jeanette had arranged to take her lunch break daily from 3 to 3:30, so that she could get her children settled in with the babysitter before she returned to work. The other clerks, Angie and Flossie, said that Jeanette never stayed in the store for lunch, because that was the time that she got her kids, and she was very protective of her children. Fortunately, all the store clerks took their breaks at the same time every day, and those times were staggered. This would become very helpful in putting together a timeline. But the fact that Jeanette's routine was different that day would be one of the things that caused confusion, and that confusion led to speculation about her husband, Alvin. There was suspicion about him based on the fact that he had been up to the store that day twice. But because him being there at all was out of the ordinary, people took that to mean something suspicious had occurred. Flossie had even told me when I spoke to her just after the first memorial walk that Jeanette had received a call and left the store that morning. She thought the call was from the school, but in going over Flossie's witness statements, she never mentioned any call to detectives, nor does anyone else. So it appears that this was one of the things over the years that was misremembered. There's no indication that Jeanette left the store that day, and in fact, she was busy from about 10:30 after that call until noon, helping carry furniture items up the stairs to the third floor where they kept the furniture. And it sounds like she was getting quite a workout, because among the things being unloaded were bed frames. After Alvin dropped Jeanette off at Gamble's for work at 9:45, he stopped at the 76 station in Reed City on the corner of Upton and Chestnut, right up the street from the Gamble store, and he got $10 worth of gas. Then he drove to Leroy, Michigan, a little town 12 or 13 miles from Reed City, to Jeanette's mother's house. There he chatted a couple minutes with her grandmother and the woman who stayed with her while Jeanette's mother, Marion Fisher, worked just down the street from Gamble's as the city clerk. Alvin spent a couple hours working on their second car that he kept there, and then he returned to the Meadowview apartment complex a couple hours later. Alvin said that when he arrived back at the apartment, he cleaned up the dishes from breakfast, and he started to prepare Jeanette's lunch, and he also put on some stew for himself. Investigators would walk him through his timeline minute by minute. He said that he boiled eggs for 15 minutes, starting around 1:20, and then he made a sandwich of egg, tuna, onions, mayonnaise and salt, and he placed all of that between two slices of bread. He put the sandwich into a baggie with a Disney character on it. And at about 1:45, he stopped at Plum's Market to get Jeanette a Faygo pop to go with her lunch. He grabbed some cigarettes and silver cleaner while he was in the store. Now, all of these locations are within about a mile radius from one another. Alvin says that he went to drop her lunch off at Gamble's directly after stopping at Plum's Market. He entered the back door. He didn't notice any trucks parked outside in the back for deliveries, and that's because by then, the deliveries had been completed. Alvin noticed an older female employee near the back door putting up stock when he entered, and he went through the store and down the stairs into the pet shop. He set his wife's brown-bagged lunch and soda on the counter near the cash register where it would later be found, and then Jeanette showed him around the pet department for a few minutes. He briefly looked at the animals and birds, and at one point he picked up a piece of petrified wood from a display. According to the diagram of the pet department prepared by Detective Pratt, the petrified wood display was near the back of the store along the east wall. That would be on your left if you were standing at the bottom of the stairs that led down into the basement pet department. It's near that area where crime scene photos showed a small stepladder and some finishing nails on the floor that had been knocked over. There was also a hammer on top of a box in that area, as if, at some point prior to the attack, Jeanette had been working in that area. Alvin said when he picked up the petrified wood, Jeanette told him he was holding about $10 worth. He said he wasn't in the basement long, and he left the gamble store no later than 2:05 p.m. As he started back up the stairs to leave, Jeanette told him to pick her up at 5:30 that evening. Alvin says she was standing at that register when he left her, and he would never see his wife again. Around the same time that Alvin had arrived with Jeanette's lunch, Hiram Thompson, a salesman who was in the store about a half hour to 40 minutes that day, says that he arrived. He says he arrived around 1:45 and he worked with David Ingalls that day on the 112 side of the building, replacing order sheets in a Morley Brothers catalog book over on the expanded into side of the store, not the side with the registers. So for the listeners who have not listened to Season 2, and I recommend that you do, the Gamble store owners had purchased the store next door. What they did was they carved out some doorways, two upstairs and one downstairs in the basement, so that they would have access back and forth from each. And so, at the time that Hiram Thompson, the salesman, was in the store, he and David Ingalls were working on that men's store side, which was right around another set of stairs that led up from the basement, which adjoined the pet store basement. Now, the medical examiner's report says that Jeanette was last seen alive at approximately 1:25 p.m., so that's the time that I had been going on previously in my research. However, the newly released witness statements tend to indicate it was later than that, because Jeanette was seen by multiple people after that time. In fact, that salesman, Hiram Thompson, who had arrived just before Alvin, would witness Jeanette come up to the main floor where he was working with David Ingalls and ask him for a hammer. David admitted in one of his interviews that he had snapped at Jeanette that day when she asked about the hammer, telling her to go look where Bonnie had last been working with it, not realizing that Jeanette wouldn't know where Bonnie had last been working because they didn't work on the same days. Now, to be fair, David Ingalls was not feeling well that day. That was established. But in my earlier research, in trying to put together a victimology on Jeanette and where she worked and the people she was involved with, I had obtained David Ingalls' personnel files from Ferris State University and documents from Crossroads Charter Academy, both places that he was involved with, and that, I learned, in the cold case documents, had made him upset. In fact, David Ingalls blamed me specifically for his, quote, mistrust of the process. He was referring to the investigative process and explaining to detectives why he did not want to give investigators a buccal swab for his DNA. In fact, none of the Ingalls, David, John, or Bonnie, would consent to turning over their saliva samples for testing, so they have never been able to be ruled out against the existing evidence. Now, I think suggesting that I'm the reason for that lack of cooperation is disingenuous. David Ingalls told cold case investigators in 2019 that I was trying to, quote, dig up information on him. Sir, I was trying to dig up information on everyone associated with this case. I promise you are not special. What I will say is that my records request in that regard stemmed directly from a former fellow employee of Crossroads telling me that David Ingalls had a temper and was quick to anger. I felt that warranted investigation, as I assume it would have investigators had they been given that information. However, after going through all of it, there wasn't much to be found in his employment records. Among the mostly very positive observations, the word impatient did come up twice. Dave is impatient with people or processes that are slow to change, one performance evaluation noted. Another read, he has a definite view of how things should operate and makes sure that view is heard. As one who likes to drive change, he can be impatient with those slower to embrace change. I also noted, as I reviewed those personnel files, that on his employment applications, in every instance where he would have to mention the store, he never referred to it as Gamble's. On his resume and the application for employments with Ferris University, David Ingalls listed the Gamble store as Ace Hardware and Home Center. Now, I suspect that was to keep future employers from associating him with the name Gamble's and the homicide that had occurred in it. However, being impatient and not wanting your name associated with a murder that occurred in your business does not make you a murderer. Yes, David Ingalls told Detective Pratt that he had snapped at Jeanette on the day of her murder when she asked for a hammer that day. But I think it's important to remember that it was a physically demanding couple of hours during that morning of unloading multiple trucks, and he wasn't feeling well that day. From about 10:30 a.m. to just after noon, Jeanette, David Sandlin, a local man who was hired just for the day to help with this task, and John Ingalls, David Ingalls' brother, who was the store manager, were all carrying items all over the store. Some of those items were furniture that had to be carried up the stairs to the third level. David Ingalls said in one of his statements that his task that day was to check supplies against the invoices as they came in. So it sounds like the other three, Sandlin, Jeanette, and John Ingalls, were doing the heavy lifting. John Ingalls, the manager, had been working with a new hire, David Sandlin, all day, bringing furniture upstairs and moving stock into the store aisles to be put up. When that last truck was emptied of the items to be left at Gamble's, both John and David Sandlin got in the truck and went with the driver to what David Ingalls called a warehouse to finish unloading items. The police report never mentions where this warehouse was located, but during my initial research into the case years ago, I learned that the Ingalls owned a storage unit, a Quonset cut building, one of those prefabricated semicircular structures, and in this case, it had three what looked like garage doors that opened. Basically, it was a storage unit that was located on Lincoln and DeKalb Streets in Reed City, less than a mile away. Again, this is only a guess because the report doesn't say where this warehouse was, but it had to have been close because David Ingalls said that all of the trucks were unloaded and they made that trip off-site all before noon. John Ingalls said that it was right around 12:30 when he gave Sandlin an hour lunch and the man left around 12:30 or 12:45. John said that he then went to lunch at the same time as Sandlin, which makes sense because Sandlin wasn't a regular employee. He was only there that day to help unload the trucks, and John Ingalls was the store manager. Sandlin was working hand in hand with John that day while David was busy checking in the stock in another part of the store, making sure that they were getting everything that they were paying for, and John was managing the unloading of the trucks. Sandlin said he went home to have lunch because he lived close by, and he returned around 1:05. John Ingalls told investigators that he ate lunch that day in his car, in the parking lot behind the store, to escape the customers, who he said always seemed to have questions if they saw you in the store. He liked to eat in peace. Having worked in retail, I can relate. You don't want to eat with an eyesight of customers, or you will never consume a single peaceful morsel. John Ingalls says that when he returned from lunch about 1:20, he went downstairs to the pet department to get some gerbil food for his kid's pet. There he saw a male customer standing near the gravel bins to the far south of the pet shop on the east wall. And that would be near where I told you where the items, the hammer and the nails and the little step stool were located, right there. He said that Jeanette came out of the back room behind him and asked if she could help him, so that tells us he was standing over where the gerbil food was. John said that he first thought she was talking to the customer when she came out, but then she asked him again, and she laughed. John said that they talked for a minute, and then he went upstairs with his gerbil food and paid for it at the upstairs register. He said in that first interview, he didn't recall Jeanette speaking to that customer while he was down there. Now, I'm not sure why John didn't have Jeanette ring up his pet food right there if she was standing there speaking to him, as he said she was, and she had asked him specifically if he needed any help. John said that he resumed work on the second floor in the furniture department area, checking in stock as David Sandlin carried it up the stairs from the main floor, where it had earlier been unloaded. Now, all of that occurred before Hiram, the salesman, arrived at 145, and he and David Ingalls were working on the 112 Upton side, or the men's door side, when Jeanette had come and asked for the hammer. Alvin had left his apartment around the same time, stopped at Plum's Market, which means he was probably arriving at Gamble's just before 2 p.m. He felt that he left Gamble's after dropping off his wife's lunch no later than 2:05. Now, I will tell you that Detective Vincent, one of the two detectives who worked this case in the late 1980s, when it was reassigned, did a timed drive of Alvin's path that day. Leaving the apartment and driving to Plum's Market took 2 minutes. It took another 2 minutes to pick up the soda and silver polish and return to the car. 3 more minutes to drive to the store and park in the rear of Gamble's, and then another 3 to get out of the car, walk inside the store, down in the basement, and then talk briefly. 10 minutes from the Robertson apartment to the Gamble's pet department. And since they had talked briefly, give or take another couple minutes. When I spoke to Detective Pratt recently, I asked him if his investigation revealed whether Jeanette had gone upstairs to ask for that hammer before or after Alvin had dropped off her lunch, and he said before. Unfortunately, nobody saw Alvin leave that day, because everyone was busy putting away stock. By this time, at 2 p.m., both Sandlin and John were already back at work, and John says he was upstairs. Now, according to then-suspended Reed City police officer Ted Platts, he entered the store for the second time that day around 2:30 or 2:40. He told Detective Pratt in his interview a few days after the homicide that he had been to the Gamble store the first time that day between 10 and 11 a.m. However, he couldn't remember anything about that visit. He couldn't even remember if he had seen Jeanette that morning. Notably, it does not appear that Ted Platts purchased anything in the store that day, despite having been there, by his own admission, twice, before he would return a third time, after her body was found. Ted Platt says the second time he came into Gamble's store that day, he spent most of his time talking to John Ingalls, upstairs, while he worked. Ted says that he arrived around 2:30 or 2:40 and left at 3:09 because he looked at his watch. It is important to note for our timeline that it is most certainly at this point in the day, after Jeanette is seen asking for the hammer, sometime just after 2 o'clock when Alvin last saw her, and before 2:25, when two women and two children would arrive, that the killer got down into the basement and whatever happened with Jeanette began. Because a set of customers, Jan and Venus and two children, will arrive about 2:25. And from that point on, there will be multiple customers down there in the pet department until they are checked out by David Ingalls right around 3 p.m.
My two boys had to go upstairs to go to the bathroom, but then there was nobody downstairs. So my sister-in-law went up the stairs, and then my two boys went with her. I felt like I must have been down there at least 10 minutes by myself. Because by the time she went up there to find an attendant to help, and I think they actually were wondering, they thought somebody was down there to work, so it took Jan a little while to come down because, like I say, you know, she took my kids to the bathroom at the same time she was up there, but it took them a little while, I think, to get somebody to come down. So they left me down there by myself, but like I say, I didn't move around much, but my sister-in-law, when she was down there, she did look into that door. There was a door over there cracked open. That's what I remembered. The light show, and my sister-in-law, she's an inquisitive one, and you know, there's people that do like to peek and stuff, and they're not afraid to, and she was just seeing what was in the other room, but it was quiet, and I think that's where the birds were, I believe. But she didn't see anything, and it was very quiet, but I saw the light through the door. Now, see, I would have never walked up to the door, but she did, and she did peek inside. And there were birds back there, but I don't remember hearing them chirp or anything or peep or make their noises. So I think it was quiet in that room. The police told me, because I think we had to go talk separately or whatever, that they even thought at that time that he could have been in that room and that she was probably already, he probably had just killed her or whatever. you know, that they thought he could have still been hiding in there, or they just thought it was a good thing, like, Jan didn't go all the way in there, because if he would have been still in there, what he possibly could have done.
At 2:48 on the main floor, David Engel says he looked at the clock after Angie approached him and said he needed to wait on some customers down in the pet department because Jeanette was nowhere to be found, and there was a couple of women and some kids down there who had been waiting a while. About 10 minutes later, while Jane and Venus were still downstairs, a local man named Mr. Cassavetes arrived at the store right around 3 p.m. for some fish and gerbil food. He said that he saw David Ingalls descend the stairs into the pet department just as he entered, and he walked down behind him moments later. David Ingalls says that he went into the back room and got some fish for the women, who had picked out fish and other items. He entered that back room along the west wall through the door in the middle of the room, which is on the right side wall if you're standing at the bottom of the stairs. And this is the same door that John Ingalls said that Jeanette had come out of earlier to ask him if he needed any help. So David Ingalls goes in that door, and he proceeds to dip some fish for the women. He mentioned that he was having some trouble with the bags leaking. Now, alarmingly, in Detective Pratt's report, he notes that where David Ingalls would have gone to retrieve the fish from the tanks for the women was about 8 feet from a large pool of blood on the ground behind the other door at the far end of the store and about 10 feet from Jeanette's body. She would later be found tucked beneath some bird cages around the corner. So if David Ingalls didn't walk that far down past the fish tanks to the end of the back of the storage room, he might not have seen her. David Ingalls didn't mention seeing anything on the floor, but when the cold case detective spoke with the Ingalls, his wife Bonnie told them that David had told her that while he was dipping those fish, he bent down by the bird cages and saw what he thought was a pool of water by one of the tanks. She said he later learned it was blood. So if he did in fact bend down by the bird cages while he was back there dipping those fish that day, he had most certainly walked further into the back room than behind the fish tanks, because the bird cages were at the back area where Jeanette was found. However, it was dark back there, and Jeanette's body was tucked behind a door to that bird area where he would not have seen her if he did not peek through or open that door. So it is certainly possible that he had seen the blood, thought it was water, and not seen Jeanette. He was hurrying to help customers who were waiting for him. At some point during this transaction with the women, David Ingalls rang up Mr. Cassavetes, who took his gerbil and fish food upstairs, and he exited the store. While he was down in the pet department, Cassavetes noticed another male customer downstairs as well. Ted Platt says he exited the store at 3:09, chatting briefly with someone whose name is redacted from the report, outside by their vehicles, before Platt went to pick up his wife at 3:20, where she was working in town. Angie says that she saw Jan and Venus and the children, as well as Mr. Cassavetes, both leave before she took her afternoon break. It was a 15-minute break, and she left at 3:15. Tom Hawkins, a customer, said he dropped Elkie off at 3:20 in front of the store. She was hoping to get rid of some gerbils that Jeanette had told her she would buy. So the time before Elkie arrives and after the last batch of customers left is the first potential time that the killer, if he was stuck in the back room, could have made a break for it, escaping before Elkie went downstairs. Tom Hawkins had been working on a car that day, and he got a call from Elkie's husband asking him to take Elkie to Gamble's because she didn't have a working vehicle at the time. Tom left the car that he was working on, went to Elkie and Carl's place, which was in Meadowview, where Jeanette lived, they were neighbors, and took Elkie to Gamble's. Tom dropped Elkie off at the store and went to the 76 station to get gas, then returned to park by the store. He waited in the car. Around the time Elkie entered the store, David Ingalls was on the main floor ringing someone up who had bought antifreeze and a thermostat for their Plymouth Fury. That person's name is also redacted. After he was rung up, he took his purchases and went out the back door of Campbell's into the back parking lot, and he put those items into his vehicle, tossing the empty packaging into the dumpster out back. Detective Pratt was able to find that empty packaging and the receipt with the time on it. Meanwhile, Elkie, who had gone straight down to the pet department while that was happening, waited about 5 or 10 minutes, but no one was down there, and no Jeanette. She says she went to a back door that was on the north wall behind the cash register, and she knocked on it, but she didn't get any answer. Then she pressed the buzzer next to the register, and she could hear it buzzing in the back room, but there was no response. Elkie then went upstairs to ask where Jeanette was, and Flossie told her that Jeanette was probably at lunch, because that was Jeanette's normal lunchtime. Flossie said that Elkie came up the first time around 3 o'clock, and then came up again asking about Jeanette at 3:15 or 3:20, and she seemed somewhat mad, Flossie said. Elkie had even used the phone upstairs to call the Robertson household, asking for Jeanette, and she was told at that time that Jeanette wasn't there. At this point, Flossie tells Angie that she's short of change, and so Angie runs to the bank. Elkie goes back downstairs, and she peers through that clear tarp that's hanging between the two basements into the unrenovated space. She said she actually put her nose up to the plastic, but she didn't see anyone. So she starts browsing the pet shop again, waiting. And while she's walking around, she notices a wet area on the carpet along the west wall. She thought it was water, but the report suggests that it was blood.
It was eerie quiet. I mean, you couldn't hear a sound, and it should have told me that something was up, you know, but you don't think of stuff like that. Because you couldn't even hear the birds sing, and that should have told you something. But I waited for quite a long time, just looking at the aquariums, and I went down there to give her some of the gerbils. I guess we had some gerbils, and they had babies, and she said she was going to buy them from me. And after, don't ask me how long I was down there. I have no clue, but it seemed like a long time. And then finally I went back upstairs and I looked for the first person that worked there. And I asked if, you know, Jeanette was coming anytime soon. And they told me that, you know, she's probably out at lunch. So I went back downstairs and I waited some more.
Tom Hawkins, who had earlier dropped Elkie off and was waiting in the car, said he waited about 15 minutes and then he went inside to see what was taking so long. And this was right around the time that Larry Kaling arrived at 3:30 to get coffee down at the coffee house with David Ingalls, as was their custom. But that day, David told him he was too busy to leave, and so they talked for a few minutes, long enough for Larry to talk him into reconsidering that coffee. Angie says they left while she was at the bank, where she had gone around 3:40. When Angie returned from the bank, David Ingalls and Larry Kaling had already gone down to get coffee at the coffee house, which was just a couple doors down, and Flossie was ringing up a customer. And at that point, somebody noticed that Jeanette's coat was lying over by the nails.
We had to get a battery for the car, so that's why I didn't drive the car. Because normally I would take the car to school. Oh, I just remember, you know, going in, my mom had to get a couple things from Gamble store anyway, you know, and then the battery, and it was just me and my mom. We went in, and one of the ladies, I think her name was Flossie, but I'm not sure. There was somebody that, you know, my mom and dad knew that worked there. She was helping us with the batteries and stuff. And we were kind of waiting at the counter because she didn't really know much about the batteries, so she was waiting for the owner to come down and help.
Okay.
And then I can just remember... We were standing by the cash register, which is at the, they had a cash register in the middle of the store, which is like right by where the stairs are to go upstairs and downstairs.
Okay.
And somebody came up looking for Jeanette. And they said they looked all over, and I think it was Flossie. Went downstairs to see if she could find Jeanette, and she come up white as a ghost. And that's when the owner went down there, and he came up and said, well, there's nothing we can do for her. And then he made everybody leave the store, which I don't understand that. You would have thought he would have made everybody stay in the store, because that way everybody would have been there to talk to the police and all that, but...
Yeah, that is
interesting. He made everybody leave, which was a big mistake on his part.
Now, do you, well, let me go back first. Angie's the one that found her, so it was probably Angie that you were talking to, because
okay.
Angie went down. I just wanted to clear that up just so you knew, and then for the listener. But so when you were standing there and Angie was helping you find the battery, you, I think you previously told me she was looking it up in a book or something. Is that right?
Yeah.
She was trying to...
Yeah, looking it up, trying to find it.
Okay, so it's like one of those things where you don't know which battery goes for your specific car, so she looks it up and then they pull it off the shelf. Is that basically how it works?
Yeah.
And then when
and
you...
that's when she was right in the middle of that, and they were looking for Jeanette.
Okay. And why
and
is... How is it that she's the one that ended up going down there? If she was helping you, how is it that she was the one that ended up going downstairs?
The owner asked her to go.
Okay, so a man came up that you think was the owner and asked her to go downstairs to look for Jeanette?
Yeah.
And so this is the part that always is interesting to me, because she was helping you. You were a customer and she was in the middle of helping you. And so he told her to stop what she was doing and go down and look for Jeanette.
Yeah, then he was trying to find the battery. Then, you know, then he started looking it up in the book. So he sent her downstairs, and then he was looking for the right battery.
Okay. And then...
I don't understand why he didn't just go down and look.
So I guess she came up. She must have gone down there, saw her, and came up before you got your transaction was complete, so you never ended up getting that battery.
No.
Okay. Now, so when she came up, was that same man the one that went down after her to look?
Yes.
Okay, so you only ever saw one man?
Yeah.
Mark recalled who he had called the store owner coming over to ask Angie to go down and look for Jeanette. But if that occurred, it had to be John Ingalls, the manager, not David Ingalls, because David was already at the coffee house at that point. So, Angie goes downstairs, where Elkie and Tom are still waiting, and she notices that the north door on the west wall is open. That's the door that's about in the center of the room. Angie says that she approached the bird enclosure at the far south area of the back room, and she saw what she also thought was water on the floor behind that south door on the west wall.
Yeah, she went in there, and I kind of followed her, but I didn't go all the way through because you could see it right from the doorway, I think. I saw, all I saw was her red hair. It was red, I mean bloody. And her hair used to be so beautiful. And now like a, almost like white, you know, the blonde. And all I saw was just blood.
Having entered that back room, Angie didn't clock that blood at first. She saw that the door to the bird housing area beyond the blood was closed. So she walked over and looked inside. And that's when she saw Jeanette's bloodied, half-dressed body laying on the floor inside the bird enclosure. I can only imagine how immediately confusing and horrifying it had to be for everyone who saw her that day, law enforcement included. Things like this did not happen in Reed City, especially not in the middle of the day, in the middle of a store. Out in the pet department proper, Elkie and Tom heard Angie make a sound from that back room, and then that back south door flew open and Angie came out of it. She just ran past them and upstairs to get John, where he was working. In a statement that he gave to Detective Pratt 2 days after the homicide, Tom Hawkins described going into the store after waiting a while outside and Elkie had not come out. He said once he was downstairs, he saw a man and a woman and a child. And he said just after he arrived in the basement, those individuals went up the stairs. Elkie went back upstairs again to see if Jeanette was there. And he recalled, in fact, hearing Elkie talking on the phone. That's when she had called the Robertson house and was told that Jeanette wasn't home, she was working. When Elkie came back down the stairs, they each got a gumball from the gumball machine that was on the counter. And Tom said that he did not see the woman store clerk come down the stairs, but he did see her go running back up after she had gone in the back room. And then shortly thereafter, approximately 3 minutes, he said a skinny guy came downstairs who worked there. He said that employee, which appears to have been John Ingalls, went in that far south door on the west wall and then told Tom and Elkie that he was a police officer. Tom told him that he had medical experience and asked if he could be of assistance. And John told him that possibly he could, so the two of them re-entered the back area, and Tom said that he saw blood on the floor behind what was the south door along the west wall, and he watched John Ingalls open the caged bird housing area by the wire mesh on the door. Tom said that he saw what he thought was a tampon laying on the floor, and he wondered what had happened. He then looked into the bird housing area, and he saw Jeanette, and he said to John that it looked real bad. He said John asked him to take her pulse, to which Tom replied, no, it wouldn't do any good. Tom said that while he and Elke just basically stood there, John went back up the stairs and came back shortly with a guy in coveralls behind him. And he told this individual, who would have been David Sandlin, to go stand by that door, indicating the south door on that west wall, which would have been where you would see the blood if you entered immediately. And John told Sandlin not to let anyone touch it. And then he went upstairs, and Angie ran down to the coffee house to get David Ingalls. Someone called police, and then multiple officers from multiple agencies arrived shortly thereafter. They estimate that Jeanette was found about 3:50, and the first responders from the Reed City Police Department arrived right at 4 o'clock. The EMTs arrived at 4:06, according to Gary McGee's report.
Everybody that was in the store walked out. We all walked out about at the same time.
You had told me also at one point that you thought you had gone next door to Ben Franklin. Do you remember going over there instead of getting right in the car and leaving?
Yeah, we didn't get right in the car and left. We wanted to find out what was going on.
Okay.
And we went into Ben Franklin and looked around. Then when the cops came, we were outside. And the only cop that I remember seeing was Larry Finkbinder. Okay. I know he was there because I remember seeing him there.
Do you remember seeing him inside or outside of the store?
He was outside the store because I just remember the car pulling off and him getting out of the car.
And
that's when we left.
How long do you think it was that you guys were in the store once she was discovered? Just minutes and then you left? It was like he was hurrying to get everyone out?
Yeah, it was probably less than 5 minutes. Because there was two girls working and then there was a guy in there working. And they just started at the back of the store and pushed everybody right out the front door.
Do you remember seeing anyone actually calling the police while you were there?
No, I don't. I remember the guy came upstairs, said, there's nothing we can do for her now. He says, we got to get everybody out. And they just started pushing everybody out, and I don't, you know who called the cops.
All right, so, and then you didn't see the police till you came out of the Ben Franklin after that.
Right.
Stay tuned.